Welcome to the West Virginia Soccer Association Beyond the Pitch podcast here on the West Virginia Soccer Association Digital Network. My name is Marcus Cole. Before we begin today's show, just wanted to remind you that once you've had a chance to check out our program, make sure you give our podcast a 5-star rating and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. That helps you stay up to date on all the latest content from us, and it helps us get the word out to others and let them know that we're providing valuable information for soccer players, coaches, referees, and parents. On the phone with us is Andrew Wiseman, head of performance for the Utah Royals FC of the National Women's Soccer League. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. My pleasure to be asked on board.
Well, we're glad that you are here. Andrew is coming off of a presentation that he just recently gave in Kentucky for the Kentucky Youth Soccer Association, talking about periodization. But before we dive into that, Andrew, why don't you go ahead and give our listeners a little bit of background about you and your dealings with soccer over the years?
Yeah, so originally, as you can probably tell by the accent, I'm from the UK, just outside London. I've been playing soccer since I was 9 years of age, and I was lucky enough to spend some time at some pro clubs as a youth, and probably not quite good enough to have made it. But then when I was around about 18, 19, I picked up the first of many serious injuries, which effectively ended my professional career or any further aspirations. But I got back and I carried on playing in the UK and over in Ireland for a few years. When I was in Ireland, I began a degree in sports science with the help of the Professional Footballers Association. At the same time, I was also running a coaching business. So maybe stupidly enough, I gave up that degree. And in 2010, I returned to the UK. About a year later, I was talked into playing a game, and unfortunately suffered another bad injury on my left ankle, and that kind of left me contemplating at the age of, I think I was 34, what am I going to do? So I contacted my uni again. Unfortunately, I lost my funding from the PFA, but I contacted Manchester Metropolitan. And they said, we'd be happy to have you back. So that was the start of sort of my academics. I studied there for about 5 years, graduating with first class in exercise and sports science. During that time, I was lucky enough to spend a season with Charlton Athletic. Their head of performance invited me down originally to have a look around. I ended up assisting through the 2013-14 season with their first team there, which was interesting. It was a season where they nearly got relegated, but they stayed up. So I got to see, I think we went through three managers in one season. So I really got to see sort of, you know, some of the pros and cons maybe of the applied side of sports science while continuing to study. I spent a season with Stevenage, which is pretty local to me, in their academy, working mainly with their under-18s. But had quite an extensive experience across the academy, really, from the sort of under-9s all the way up. From there, I left Stevenage, and I was lucky. I'm a lifelong Celtic fan due to family from Ireland and Glasgow. And they were on the phone, and they said, would you like to come up and meet us? And I went and met them, and I ended up working as eventually head of sports science for their women's setup. Did a little bit of work with the International Academy there at Celtic, and I spent 3 good years there, probably the most successful period in the club, which is still going. They're still quite successful, but, you know, Brendan Rodgers was there at the time. Ronnie Dyer, actually, who's at New York City now, was the manager when I started there, and then Brendan Rodgers on the men's side. So I was really lucky to be exposed to those guys, along with the superb coaches in the women's setup. So that really started to, when Brendan was there and the models that he brought started to sort of spark my interest in periodization and maybe question it a little bit more. From there, I left. I went down to Exeter City in League Two in down there in Devon. I looked after the first team and the under 23s, which was an experience. I decided to leave there at the end of the season. We didn't quite make the playoffs, but I left there, and I was lucky enough to get a phone call from Laura Harvey, who's now with US Soccer. But Laura phoned me and asked me if I would be interested in coming to the United States, and I think that had been a long-term ambition of mine. And that was in, I arrived here in August, and I'm still here. So pretty good, pretty varied in the things I've done. I've published a couple of articles on in female soccer, so I've been lucky in the academic side as well. So pretty varied experience, but enjoying the USA at the moment.
Well, it sounds like quite a journey. Now, I mentioned before that you were recently in Kentucky with the Kentucky Youth Soccer Association giving a presentation about periodization. Now, we see a lot of talk about this online, and I don't think maybe a lot of people quite understand what it is all about. Can you give our listeners a basic layman's overview of what periodization is about?
So periodization really is just the manipulation of training or training stress to gain a physical outcome or a physiological outcome, which in turn should lead to success. The sort of origins appeared around the Olympics and the ancient Greeks and Romans, and it's been around a while, but it didn't really start to become prominent in training maybe at the turn of the 1900s. It was used in a couple of different sports, Pekala, I think 1913, and Kotov. And then a little bit later, around about 1936, the phasic approach, I think it was Grattan, that was the sort of phasic approach to training methodology. Moving on a little bit later, sort of the training, the essence of periodization and the modern sort of origins of that, they began in the, especially around the Soviet Union and weightlifting. And there was a lot of written by Mateyev, who's sort of like the modern godfather of periodization. So as you could probably understand from that, it came from an individual sport, manipulating variables over various cycles so that the weightlifters would perform and break world records and qualify for the Olympics or whatever they were doing. Generally, as an overview, sort of periodized training, you're looking at the planning sort of sessions of overload, unloading, alternating those, and not fatiguing someone enough that they don't perform. However, sometimes that's needed, that little bit of fatigue. So it's generally split into blocks. You've got a macrocycle, which would be 1 to 4 year blocks if you're working with an Olympic athlete. Then you've a mesocycle, which can be anything to 4 to 6 week block within that macro, and then micro, which is generally in soccer a weekly training plan. Soccer's a little bit different. I think we have a very long competitive phase. So if it's split into phases of a macrocycle, you would have like a transition phase, mainly the off-season, a preparation phase, which is split into two blocks of general and specific preparation, then a long competitive phase, and then just cycles around in there. Whereas in something like weightlifting, they don't compete as often as a soccer player, which could be once or twice a week. So it's been around a while. It's in modern times, it started to become a little bit more prominent within the literature.
Now, you mentioned in there too about there's times where you have to push the athlete, and then there's times where you kind of back off the athlete a little bit in their workloads and things along that lines. Kind of dive into that a little bit more as far as that physiological effect response for the players to their trainings and their games and their workouts and things along that lines.
Yeah, so we probably need to start to look at the dose response. So obviously apply a stimulus and get a response from that. So what's known as a dose response relationship, funny enough. It's an interesting one because it's taken off a couple of different models there. Probably the most famous it would be Selye's general adaptation syndrome model. which started to appear around about the 30s, and by 1956 it became a little bit more prominent in his writings. But in essence, it's just applying a stimulus. There's certain phases, an alarm phase, that's the immediate reaction. Resistance phase, the body then adapts to that. So if you're thinking of lifting weights, you know, you do bicep curls, your biceps grows, you've got that super compensation. And then you have the recovery or exhaustion phase. So recovery is pretty simple. And then you apply another stimulus. If you get exhaustion phase, you know, it could be responded negatively to the stress that's been applied. Again, if you're lifting weights, it's the stress of tearing those muscle fibers and growing the muscle. But the body can adapt positively or negatively, depend when you apply the next stress. So that kind of makes sense, but it's a very singular model, and you're only talking about singular entities. So this has kind of been adapted. Selye, actually, he started to look at that in rats. That was his original thesis, and he wanted to discover this new hormone, which was his big dream. He started to begin demonstrated the brain and body adaptation, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or HPA, and it really was like from there the essence of periodization was taken on that from a physiological perspective. But footballers during a training week go through a lot of different training stresses. So if you're talking essentially in weightlifting, that's quite a singular and compartmentalized area, apply the stress and get an outcome. However, everybody responds differently to training and the training response. There was a couple of more models that were developed over time. Bannister was the next, and a fitness fatigue model. They were all taken in essence from from Selye's model. But all he said was like there's two internal effects when a training stimulus is applied, which would be fitness positive and fatigue negative, and in essence you need both. And then a later one was the stimulus fatigue recovery adaptation, which is just an extension of both those models. What they identified was like if training stopped for a period of time, then a detraining effect will occur and bring the player back to pre-training level. So, you know, as I said earlier, you want to grow your biceps and keep applying that stimulus of your resistance training. As soon as you stop, you're going to go back to that pre-training level. So it's quite complex. Human physiology is incredibly complex. So the older period, or the foundations of periodization, maybe don't apply so much in soccer, because we're working with up to 22, 23 athletes at a time. So it's very easy to say that, you know, do this and that will occur, when actually that's not the case at times. So having an understanding of our athletes and how they're responding is far more important, I think.
What I mean, you are so correct when you say that this is a very complex issue, just because there's so many different facets to it, and especially the science behind it. What are some mistakes that you see that soccer coaches make with their players? I guess with a basic element of periodization, when you think about that, I mean, what are some of the mistakes that coaches may be making with their players in regards to that?
That's an interesting one, because I've been exposed to quite a few different coaches. I think it makes absolute sense to taper off before a game, because we want to get the players prepared. So if we look at the Bannister's model, player preparedness is actually the difference between the positive effects of fitness and the negative effects of fatigue. So it makes absolute sense to taper off within a week. That's pretty common. Match day minus one, match day minus two are nowhere near as intensive as maybe a match day minus three, match day minus four session, depending on which way you look at it. Some of the common mistakes, shall I say, would be to have too much volume in the sessions closer to the game. You know, quality is better than quantity. I think it's, you know, I spoke to someone in Kentucky and, you know, how do I manage that? Because I've just used time. So if your session's over 72 hours away from the game, if they're an hour and a half, it's probably not going to have that much of an effect on the player. If you're then doing an hour and a half, 2 hour sessions the day before a game, that's an awful lot of volume for a player. So it's understanding the manipulation of the time variables in space and time. So tactical periodization tends to look at the different spaces in space and time and manipulates those based on their outcomes and how they see the game. So in essence, they'll tell you in a tactical periodization model that your strength day will be those smaller spaces and you'll get more high accelerations and decelerations. You know, that makes sense to keep that further away from the game. Sometimes we can see coaches often go into really small spaces the day before a game and exposing players to those axials and decels. I don't think there's any actual right or wrong model. But I do think it should be in coaches' mind about how much the players are doing closer to the game. I think that's more of an important time. So those sort of 2 days before a game, they're the most important. And I've seen excess volume in those times. That doesn't mean players don't actually perform, but I think if you build that up over a period of time, that can have maybe a detrimental effect. I think it's knowing when to push and knowing when to pull. And that comes down to actually understanding your players, how they're responding and knowing what they can tolerate. And that can be difficult when you've got 20, 30 players to look after in a season.
It's a different model. I mean, you might be familiar with the various models being around as much as you have been. Here in West Virginia, the club models, you train for weeks at a time and then you go to a tournament or an event or things along that lines. High school soccer here in West Virginia is a little bit different. Actually, the opposite end of the spectrum. We do have some high school coaches that listen to our podcast. What advice would you give to them as far as the workloads and things along that lines when they're required to play 2 to 3 matches per week, and then they have a mandatory day off on a Sunday, mandated by the Secondary Activities Commission, and trying to, prepare their players better? I mean, what advice would you give to them when they have that kind of a model?
Yeah, so if you're recording the time of the sessions, you can use something simple like an RPE. It's pretty much validated to see how the players are responding. So really simply just multiply the time by the player's RPE score. And there's Google Sheets apps or whatever that players can submit that. And just taking something as simple as that, you can start to understand how the players are responding and how they're feeling. There are wellness questionnaires as well. Obviously, we use those daily, but you can use them 2-3 times a week if you don't have the manpower to do that, and gradually form a picture of your players and how they're feeling, how they're responding to the training sessions. RPE is like everything else. There's flaws to it. We're blessed. We have objective data as well that we can match it up, such as heart rate and obviously GPS. But if people don't have those budgets, then there's no reason why just recording the time using your RPE and then multiplying that from each player will give you a good idea of load, and you can start to see how the players are getting on. I don't think that's a bad way. I've said that to a lot of high school coaches. If you've got an assistant that can do that, start to take that data. I think one of the things with RPE is it can be peer influenced. So, sometimes an app isn't the best way. Sometimes it is. Some people prefer that pen and paper model. I've certainly done that in my time. Stood at a clipboard at the end of training and just asked people what was that, on a 1 to 10 or whatever scale we're using, and they'll give you that information. So I think that's a good way just to start to quantify. Obviously, it's maybe my scientific mind, but you'll be able to see, how the players are and how they're responding, and that will help you a lot within your training week.
Will you see patterns developing and you can kind of go from there when you see those patterns? Would that be a correct assessment?
Yeah, I think again, I think we have to be conscious that everybody will respond differently, but you will start to see patterns, and you know, you can start to use certain statistics and Z-scores and those kind of things, getting a little bit deeper to see how, you know, that's affecting someone, and whether there's a change in time, or whether that change is significant enough, or the smallest worthwhile change, you know, to make an intervention. That's maybe getting a little bit later down the line. But yes, you do see trends. I think if I was to generalize a little bit, match day plus one will be okay in subjective scores. Match day plus two tends to be when players are at their lowest. Robin Thorpe, formerly Man United, now at Altus down in Phoenix, did some great research on that. And you can see that sort of that drop off match day plus two, which then means that you need to adapt that session. And that you can use subjective or objective data. I prefer to use both for obvious reasons, but you will see trends within those first few days after a game.
Andrew, before we wrap things up here, can you give us give our coaches just maybe 1 point or 2 points that they should be thinking about when it comes to periodization in their players?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the technical models of periodization are slightly different to the physical, but I think you have to be conscious of both. I think it has to be holistic. We tend to look at fatigue as a single entity, and it's not a single entity. There's so many things that can affect, actually there's things that can affect the load on the player and their response. You know, these days we've got social media you know, at the higher level, maybe peer influences and press and sponsorships. So I think we have to understand that load is multifaceted in that sense, and the response to it, fatigue can come from many different things. So I think invisible monitoring of your players and understanding and just asking them how they're feeling, like I say, simple data like the time and the RPE, gradually you'll get to know what those players and how they're responding. That then can work with your technical model. So if you know that you're going into a session that may expose them to a little bit more and the players haven't responded well to that, you can just adapt it. I think at times, you know, I think I said it earlier that, you know, quality is better than quantity a lot of the time. And I understand that technical coaches want to spend a lot of time on the pitches with the players. It's great. It's a technical, tactical sport. So I have to take my physical hat off at times. But I think, you know, if you work on your week and do the most stressful work at the sort of the middle of the week and then taper off towards games, you won't go too far wrong. Essentially, all the models, right or wrong, and I could argue all day long about the flaws of some of the periodization. Actually, I said it earlier, it was taken from individual sports. You know, you could argue about that all day long, but they essentially all have some form of overload and some form of taper within a weekly cycle. Your match loads should be your highest. They should be your highest within a training week, or they will be your highest. If you're going above match load in a training session, then you're likely to find fatigued players. And that's not science, that's probably common sense.
Andrew, how can people find out more? Or, I mean, you're a great follow on Twitter. Where can they find you online?
I have a blog site. I probably haven't updated it in that long, but it's soccerologysite.blog. So a lot of my work's up there, some of my published work up there, and some guest blogs on there. I probably need to do a bit more work on that, but it's not my priority. But yeah, I try and put as much of my work up there as I can. Obviously on Twitter at Mr. Wiseyman, you know, I'm always open to questions, and you know, if anyone's got any, they can find me on Twitter. Like I say, it's probably best to emphasise that, you know, there's no right or wrong way with periodization, or no right or wrong model. Although the sort of empirical and peer reviewed literature is really, really, you know, is quite weak. So we probably need more research within team sports. Again, there's a lot of nuances in that, and it's not that easy. I think for coaches, the head coach determines everything. What is their playing model? You know, and you have to almost use a bottom-up approach or top-down and try and understand, you know, how that playing model will dictate the periodization model. I think the physical side is secondary to the head coach's technical tactical model. I've seen it at times where it's, you know, the physical side is completely different to the playing model. A good example maybe was Klopp against Rodgers. Two different styles of playing. Klopp came in, was heavily criticised by one Dutch coach about the injury rate, but they are completely different physical demands on those players. So I think the head coach's model should dictate everything.
Andrew, thank you so much for coming on our show today and providing this information to our listeners. And good luck to the Royals this year.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to the West Virginia Soccer Association Beyond the Pitch podcast here on the West Virginia Soccer Association Digital Network. Now that you've heard our show, make sure you give our podcast a 5-star rating and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next Thursday with another episode, so we hope to see you here next week. Take care.